perched chateau, whole and ruined, autumn greens of copses and solitary pines all deepening to the nightscape latent across them all day. Fires are lit on the beach, a faint babble of English voices, and even occasional songs reaches across the water to where Dr. Porkyovich stands on deck. Below, Octopus Grigori, having stuffed himself with crab meat, frisks happily in his special enclosure. The reaching radius of the lighthouse on the headland sweeps by as tiny fishing craft head out to sea. Grisha, little friend, you have performed your last trick for a while. Is there any hope for further support from pointsmen now that Porkyovich and his fabulous octopus have done their part? He gave up questioning orders long ago, even questioning his exile. The evidence linking him to the Bukharin conspiracy, whose particulars he has never heard, might somehow be true. The Trotskyite bloc might have known of him by reputation, used him in ways forever secret. Forever secret. There are forms of innocence, he knows, that cannot conceive of what that means, much less accept it as he has. For it might, after all, be only another episode in some huge pathological dream of Stalin's. At least he had physiology, something outside the party, those who had nothing but the party, who had built their whole lives upon it only to be purged, must go through something very like death. And never to know anything for certain, never to have the precision of the laboratory. It's been his own sanity, God knows, for 20 years. At least they can never... No. No, they wouldn't. There's never been a case. Unless it's been hushed up. You'd never read it in the journals, of course. Would pointsman? He might. Yes. Grisha. Grisha. It's come true. On us so quickly. Foreign cities. Comedians in broken hats. Can-can girls. Fountains of fire. A noisy pit band. Grisha, with the flags of all the nations curled in your arms. Fresh shellfish, a warm pirozhok, hot glasses of tea in the evenings between performances. Learn to forget Russia, to take comfort from what mean, falsified bits of her we wander across. Now the sky stretches to admit a single first star. But Porkyovich makes no wish. Policy. Signs of arrival do not interest him, nor even signs of departure. As the boat's engine goes full ahead, their own wake goes lifting, pink with sunset, to obscure the white casino on shore. Electricity is on tonight, the casino back in France's power grid. Chandeliers shaggy with crystal needles flare overhead, and softer lamps shine among the gardens outside. Going into dinner with Pantivy and the dancers, Slothrop is brought to a round-eyed halt by the sight of Katya Borgesius, hair in one of those emerald tiaras, the rest of her rigged out in a long Medici gown of sea-green velvet. Her escort's a two-star general and a brigadier. R-H-I-P, sings Tantivy, shuffling off sarcastic buffaloes along the carpet. Oh, R-H-I-P, indeed. You're trying to get my goat, Slothrop smiles, but it's not working. I can tell. His own smile freezes. Oh, no, Slothrop, please, no, we're going into dinner. Well, I know we're going into dinner. No, this is very embarrassing. You've got to take it off. You like that? She's genuine hand-painted. Look, nice tits, huh? It's the Wormwood Scrub School tie. In the main dining room, they merge into a great coming and going of waiters, officers, and ladies. Slothrop, young dancer by the hand, caught up in the eddying, manages at last to slide with her into a pair of seats just vacated, to find who but Katya, his left-hand partner. He puffs out his cheeks, crosses his eyes, brushes his hair industriously with his hands, by which time the soup has showed up, which he goes at as if disarming a bomb. Katya is ignoring him, talking earnestly instead across her general with some bird colonel about his pre-war profession, managing a golf course in Cornwall. Holes and hazards. Gave one a feel for terrain. But he did like most to be there at night when the badgers came out of their sets to play. By the time the fish has come and gone, something funny is happening. Katya's knee seems to be rubbing Slothrop's, velvet warm under the table. Well, opines Slothrop, watch this. I will employ some of that subterfuge. I mean, I'm in that Europe, aren't I? He raises his wine glass and announces... The Ballad of Tantivy Mucker Mephic. Cheers go up. Bashful Tantivy tries not to smile. It's a song everyone knows. One of the Scotsmen goes dashing down the room to the grand piano. Cesar Flebotimo, twirling his slick mustache in a saber point, nips behind a palm in a tub to turn the lights up a notch, sticks his head back out winking and hisses for his maître d'hôtel. Wine is gargled, throats are cleared, and a good number of the company commence singing. The Ballad of Tantivy Mucker Mephic. O Italian gin is a mother's curse, and the beer of France is septic. Drinking bourbon in Spain is the lonely domain of the saint and the epileptic. White lightning has fueled up many a hearse in the mountains where ridge runners dwell. It's a brew begot in a poisoned pot and mulled with the hammers of hell. Refrain. O Tantivy's been drunk in many a place from here to the uttermost isle. And if he should refuse any chance at the booze, may I die with an hoary-eyed smile. There are what sound like 100, but most likely only 2, Welshmen singing, tenor from the south and bass from the north of the country, you see, so that all conversation, sub rosa or not, is effectively drowned out. Exactly what Slothrop wants. He leans in Katya's direction. Meet me in my room, she whispers. 3:06 after midnight. Gotcha. And Slothrop is upright in time to join in again right on bar one. He's been ossified in oceans of grog, in the haunts of the wobbly whale. He's been half seas over from Durban to Dover with 4 shaky sheets to the gale. For in London fog or Sahara's sun or the ice-bound steeps of Zermatt, loaded up for a lark to his Plimsoll mark, he's been game to go off on a bat. Yes, Tantivy's been drunk in many a place, etc. After dinner, Slothrop gives Tantivy the high sign. Their dancers go off arm in arm to the marble lounges where the toilet stalls are equipped with a network of brass voice tubes, all acoustic, to make stall-to-stall conversation easier. Slothrop and Tantivy head for the nearest bar. Listen, Slothrop talking into his highball glass, bouncing words off of ice cubes so they'll have a proper chill. Either I'm coming down with a little psychosis here, or something funny is going on, right? Tantivy, who is feigning a relaxed air, breaks off humming, you can do a lot of things at the seaside that you can't do in town, to inquire, ah, yes, do you really think so? Come on, that octopus. The devilfish is found quite commonly on Mediterranean shores, though usually not so large. Is it the size that bothers you? Don't Americans like? Tantivy, it was no accident. Did you hear that bloat? Don't kill it. He had a crab with him, maybe inside that musette bag, all set to lure that critter away with, and where'd he go tonight, anyhow? I think he's out on the beach. There's a lot of drinking. He drinks a lot? No. Look, you're his friend, Aunt Ivy moans. God, Slothrop, I don't know. I'm your friend, too, but there's always, you know, an element of Slothropian paranoia to contend with. Paranoia's ass. Something's up, and you know it. Tantivy chews ice, sights along a glass stirring rod, rips up a small napkin into a snowstorm, all sorts of bar business, he's an old hand, but at last in a soft voice, well, he's receiving messages in code. Ha! I saw one in his kit this afternoon, just a glimpse. I didn't try to look closer. He is with Supreme Headquarters, after all, I suppose that could be it. No, that's not it. Now, what about this? And Slothrop tells about his midnight bait with Katya. For a moment, they might almost be back in the bureau at Achtung, and the rockets falling, and tea in paper cups, and everything right again. Are you going? Shouldn't I? You think she's dangerous? I think she's delightful. If I hadn't Françoise, not to mention Yvonne to worry about, I'd be racing you to her door. But the clock over the bar only clicks once. Then, presently again, ratcheting time minute-wise into their past. Either what you've got is contagious, Tantivy begins, or else they've an eye on me, too. They look at each other. Slothrop remembers that except for Tantivy, he's all alone here. Tell me. I wish I could. He's changed, but I couldn't give you a single bit of evidence. It's been since, I don't know, autumn. He doesn't talk politics anymore. God, we used to get into these... He won't discuss his plans after he's demobed, either. It's something he used to do all the time. I thought the Blitz might have got him rattled, but After yesterday, I think it must be more. Damn it, it makes me sad. What happened? Oh, a sort of... not a threat, or not a serious one. I mentioned, only joking, that I was keen on your capture. And Bloat became very cold and said I'd stay clear of that one if I were you. Tried to cover it with a laugh, as if he had his eye on her, too, but that wasn't it. I don't have his confidence anymore. I feel I'm only useful to him in a way I can't see. Being tolerated for as long as he can use me. The old university connection. I don't know if you ever felt it at Harvard. From time to time back in Oxford, I came to sense a peculiar structure that no one admitted to, that extended far beyond Pearl Street, past Corn Market, into covenants procuring accounts due. One never knew who it would be, or when, or how they'd try to collect it, but I thought it only idle, only at the fringes of what I was really up there for, you know?
Sure. In that America, it's the first thing they tell you. Harvard's there for other reasons. The educating part of it is just sort of a front.
We're so very innocent here, you see.
Some of you, maybe. I'm sorry about Bloat.
I still hope it's something else.
I guess so, but what do we do right now?
Oh, I'd say keep your date. Be careful. Keep me posted. Perhaps tomorrow I'll have an adventure or two to tell you about for a change, and if you need help, teeth flashing, face reddening a bit, well, I'll help you.
Thanks, Tantivy. Jesus, a British ally. Yvonne and Francoise peek in, beckoning them outside, onto the Himmler Spielsaal and Chemin de Fer till midnight. Sothrup breaks even, Tantivy loses, and the girls win. No sign of Bloat, though dozens of officers go drifting in and out, brown and distant as rotogravure, through the evening. Nor any sight of this girl, Giselaine. Sothrup asks. Yvonne shrugs.
Out with your friend? Who knows?
Giselaine's long hair and tanned arms, her six-year-old face in a smile. If it turns out she does know something, is she safe? At 11:59, Sothrup turns to Tantivy, nods at the two girls, tries to chuckle lewdly, and gives his friend a quick, affectionate punch in the shoulder. Once, back in prep school, just before sending him into a game, young Slothrop's football coach socked him the same way, giving him confidence for at least 50 seconds, till being trampled flat on his ass by a number of red-dogging chote boys, each with the instincts and mass of a killer rhino. "Good luck," says Tantivy, meaning it, hand already reaching for Yvonne's sweet chiffon bottom. Minutes of doubt, yes, yes. Slothrop ascending flights of red-carpeted stairway. "Welcome, Mr. Slothrop. Welcome to our structure. We hope you will enjoy your visit here." Malachite nymphs and satyrs paralyzed in chase, evergreen at the silent landings upward toward a single staring bulb at the top. At her door, he pauses long enough to comb his hair. Now she wears a white pelisse with sequins all over, padded shoulders, jagged white ostrich plumes at the neckline and wrists. The tiara is gone. In the electricity, her hair is new snowfall. But inside, a single scented candle burns, and the suite is washed in moonlight. He pours brandy in old flint snifters, and as he reaches, their fingers touch.
"Didn't know you were so daffy about that golf."
Suave, romantic Sothrup.
"He was pleasant. I was being pleasant to him."
One eye kind of squinched up, forehead wrinkled. Sothrup wonders if his fly's open.
"And ignore me. Why?"
"Clever pounce there, Sothrup. But she only evaporates before the question, reforms in another part of the room."
"Am I ignoring you?"
She's at her window, the sea below and behind her, the midnight sea, its individual wave flows impossible at this distance to follow, all integrated into the hung stillness of an old painting seen across the deserted gallery where you wait in the shadow, forgetting why you are here, frightened by the level of illumination, which is from the same blanched scar of moon that wipes the sea tonight.
"I don't know, but you're fooling around a lot."
"Perhaps I'm supposed to be."
"As perhaps we were meant to meet?"
"Oh, you think I'm more than I am,"
gliding to a couch, tucking one leg under. "I know, you're only a Dutch milkmaid or something. Closet full of those starched aprons, eh, and wooden shoes, right?"
"Go and look."
Spice odors from the candle reach like nerves through the room.
"Okay, I will."
He opens her closet, and in moonlight reflected from the mirror finds a crowded maze of satins, taffetas, lawn and pongee, dark fur collars and trimming, buttons, sashes, passementerie, soft, confusing, womanly tunnel systems that must stretch back for miles. He could be lost inside of half a minute. Lace glimmers, eyelets wink, a crepe scarf brushes his face. Aha, wait a minute. The operational scent in here is carbon tet, Jackson, and this wardrobe here is mostly props. Well, pretty snazzy.
If that's a compliment, thank you.
Let them thank me, babe, and Americanism. You're the first American I've met. You must have got out by way of that Arnhem then, right?
My, you're quick.
Her tone warning him not to go after it. He sighs, wringing the snifter with his fingernail. In the dark room, with a paralyzed and silent sea at his back, he tries singing. Too soon to know. Foxtrot. It's still too soon. It's not as if we'd kissed and kindled or chased the moon. Through midnight's hush, as dancing dwindled into quiet dawns over secret lawns. Too soon to know. If all that breathless conversation a sigh ago was more than casual flirtation, doomed to drift away into misty gray. How can we tell? What can we see? Love works its spells in hiding, quite past our own deciding. So who's to say if joyful love is just beginning, or if its day just turned to night as earth went spinning? Darling, maybe so. It's too soon to know. Knowing what is expected of her, she waits with a vapid look till he's done. Mellow, close harmony reeds humming a moment in the air, then reaches out a hand, melting toward him as he topples in slow motion toward her mouth. Feathers sliding, sleeves furling, ascending bare arms, finely moon-grained, slipping around and up his back, her tacky tongue nervous as a moth. His hands rasping over sequins. Then her breasts flatten against him as her forearms and hands go away, folding up behind her to find a zipper, bringing it snarling down her spine line. Katya's skin is whiter than the white garment she rises from. Born again. Out the window he can almost see the spot where the devilfish crawled in from the rocks. She walks like a ballerina on her toes, thighs long and curving. Slothrop undoing belt buttons, shoelaces, hopping one foot at a time. Oh boy, oh boy, but the moonlight only whitens her back, and there is still a dark side, her ventral side, her face that he can no longer see. A terrible beast-like change coming over muzzle and lower jaw, black pupils growing to cover the entire eye space, till whites are gone and there's only the red animal reflection. When the light comes to strike, no telling when the light... She has sunk to the deep bed, pulling him along into down, satin, seraphic, and floral embroidery, turning immediately to take his erection into her stretched fork, into a single vibration on which the night is tuning. As they fuck, she quakes, body strobing miles beneath him, in cream and night blue, all sound suppressed, eyes in crescents behind the gold lashes, jet earrings, long octahedral, flying without a sound, beating against her cheeks, black sleet, his face above her, unmoved, full of careful technique. Is it for her? Or wired into the Slothropian run together they briefed her on? She will move him. She will not be mounted by a plastic shell. Her breathing has grown more hoarse over a threshold into sound. Thinking she might be close to coming, he reaches a hand into her hair, tries to still her head, needing to see her face. This is suddenly a struggle, vicious and real. She will not surrender her face, and out of nowhere she does begin to come, and so does Slothrop. For some reason now, she who never laughs has become the top surface of a deep rising balloon of laughter. Later, as she's about to go to sleep, she will also whisper, laughing, laughing again. He will want to say, oh, they let you, but then again maybe they don't. But the Katya he's talking to is already gone, and presently his own eyes have closed. Like a rocket whose valves under remote control open and close at prearranged moments, Slothrop, at a certain level of his re-entry into sleep, stops breathing through his nose and commences breathing through his mouth. This soon grows to snores, that have been known to rattle storm windows, set shutters to swinging and chandeliers into violent pintinabulation. Yes, indeed, at the first of these tonight, Katya wakes up, belts him in the head with a pillow.
None of that. I'm a light sleeper. Every time you snore, you get hit with this, waving the pillow.
No kidding, either. The routine of snore, get belted with pillow, wake up, say fall back to sleep, goes on well into the morning.
Come on,
finally.
Cut it out. Mouth breather, she yells.
He grabs his own pillow and swings it at her. She ducks, rolls, hits the deck, fainting with her pillow, backing toward the sideboard where the booze is. He doesn't see what she has in mind till she throws her pillow and picks up the seltzer bottle.
The what? The seltzer bottle? What shit is this now? What other interesting props have they thought to plant? And what other American reflexes are they after? Where's those banana cream pies, eh?
He dangles two pillows and watches her.
One more step, she giggles.
Slothrop dives in, goes to hit her across the ass, whereupon she lets him have it with the seltzer bottle natch. The pillow bursts against one marble hip. Moonlight in the room is choked with feathers and down, and soon with hanging spray from jets of seltzer.
Slothrop keeps trying to grab the bottle. Slippery girl squirms away, gets behind a chair.
Slothrop takes the brandy decanter off of the sideboard, unstoppers it, and flings a clear amber pseudopotted glob across the room twice in and out of moonlight to splash around her neck, between her black-tipped breasts, down her flanks.
Bastard!
Hitting him with the seltzer again. Settling feathers cling to their skins as they chase around the bedroom, her dappled body always retreating, often in this light, even at close range, impossible to see.
Slothrop keeps falling over the furniture.
Boy, when I get my hands on you... At which point she opens the door to the sitting room, skips through, slams it again, so Slothrop runs right into it, bounces off, says shit, opens the door to find her waving a big red damask tablecloth at him.
What's this? Inquires Slothrop.
Magic,
she cries, and tosses the tablecloth over him, precisely wrinkling folds propagating swift as crystal faults readily through the air.
Watch closely while I make one American lieutenant disappear.
Quit fooling, Slothrop, flailing around trying to reach the outside again. How can I watch closely when I'm in here? He can't find an edge anyplace and feels a little panicky.
That's the idea,
suddenly inside next to him, lips at his nipples, hands fluttering among the hairs at the back of his neck, pulling him slowly to deep carpeting.
My little chickadee?
Where'd you see that one, hey? Remember when he gets in bed with that goat?
Oh, don't ask.
This time it is a good-natured, coordinated quickie, both kind of drowsy, covered with sticky feathers. After coming, they lie close together, too liquefied to move. Damask and pile. It's so cozy and just as red as a womb in here. Curled, holding her feet in his, cock nestled in the warm cusp between her buttocks, Slothrop trying earnestly to breathe through his nose, they drop off to sleep. Slothrop wakes to morning sunlight off of that Mediterranean, filtered through a palm outside the window, then red through the tablecloth, birds, water running upstairs. For a minute he lies, coming awake, no hangover, still belonging Slothropless to some teeming cycle of departure and return. Katya lies, quick and warm, est against the S of himself, beginning to stir. From the next room he hears the unmistakable sound of an army belt buckle.
Somebody,
he observes, catching on quickly, must be robbing my pants. Feet patter by on the carpet close to his head. Slothrop can hear his own small change jingling in his pockets. Thief, he yells, which wakes up Katya, turning to put her arms around him. Slothrop, managing now to locate the hem he couldn't find last night, scoots from under the tablecloth just in time to see a large foot in a two-toned shoe, coffee and indigo, vanish out the door. He runs into the bedroom, finds everything else he had on is gone, too, down to shoes and skivvies.
My clothes!
Running back out past Katya, now emerging from the damask and making a grab for his feet, Slothrop flings open the door, runs out in the hall, recollects that he is naked here, spots a laundry cart and grabs a purple satin bedsheet off of it, drapes it around him in a sort of toga. From the stairway comes a snicker and the pad-pad of crepe soles. Aha! Cries Slothrop, charging down the hall. The slippery sheet will not stay on. It flaps, slides off, gets underfoot. Up the stairs, two at a time, only to find at the top another corridor just as empty. Where is everybody?
From way down the hall, a tiny head appears around a corner. A tiny hand comes out and gives Slothrop the tiny finger. Unpleasant laughter reaches him a split second later, by which time he's sprinting toward it. At the stairs, he hears footsteps heading down. The great purple kite races, cursing down three flights, out a door and onto a little terrace, just in time to see somebody hop over a stone balustrade and vanish into the upper half of a thick tree, growing up from somewhere below. "Treed at last," cries Slothrop. First you have to get into the tree, then you can climb it easy as a ladder. Once inside, surrounded by pungent leaf light, Slothrop can't see farther than a couple of limbs. The tree is shaking, though, so he reckons that that thief is in here someplace. Industriously, he climbs on, sheet catching and tearing, skin stuck by needles, scraped by bark. His feet hurt. He's soon out of breath. Gradually, the cone of green light narrows, grows brighter. Close to the top, Slothrop notes a saw cut or something partway through the trunk, but doesn't stop to ponder what it might mean till he's reached the very top of the tree and clings, swaying, enjoying the fine view of the harbor and headland, paint-blue sea, white caps, storm gathering off at the horizon, the tops of people's heads moving around far below. Gee, down the trunk he hears the sound of wood beginning to crack and feels vibration here in his slender perch. Aw, hey... That sneak. He climbed down the tree, not up. He's down there now, watching. They knew Slothrop would choose up, not down. They were counting on that damned American reflex, all right. Bad guy in a chase always heads up. Why up? And they sawed the trunk nearly through, and now... They? Well, opined Slothrop, I had better, About then, the point of the tree cracks through, and with a great rustle and whoosh... A whirl of dark branches and needles breaking him up into a few thousand sharp falling pieces, down topples Slothrop, bouncing from limb to limb, trying to hold the purple sheet over his head for a parachute. Oof! About halfway to the ground, terrace level or so, he happens to look down and there observes many senior officers in uniform and plump ladies in white batiste frocks and flowered hats. They are playing croquet. It appears Slothrop will land somewhere in their midst. He closes his eyes and tries to imagine a tropical island, a secure room, where this cannot be happening. He opens them about the time he hits the ground. In the silence, before he can even register pain, comes the loud thunk of wood hitting wood. A bright yellow-striped ball comes rolling past an inch from Slothrop's nose and on, out of sight, followed a second later by a burst of congratulations, ladies enthusiastic, footfalls heading his way. Seems he's wrenched his back a little, but doesn't much feel like moving anyhow. Presently the sky is obscured by faces of some general and Teddy Bloat gazing curiously down. It's Slothrop, says Bloat, and he's wearing a purple sheet.
What's this, my lad? Inquires the general. Costume theatricals, eh?
He is joined by a pair of ladies beaming at, or perhaps through, Slothrop.
Whom are you talking to, general?
That blighter in the toga, replies the general, who is lying between me and my next wicket.
Why, how extraordinary, Rowena, turning to her companion. Do you see a blighter in a toga? Goodness no, Joel, replies blithe Rowena. I believe the general has been drinking. The ladies begin to giggle. If the general made all his decisions in this state, Joel, grasping for breath, why, there'd be sauerkraut in the Strand.
The two of them shriek very loudly for an unpleasant length of time.
And your name would be Brunhilde.
The two faces, now a strangled rose,
instead of Jewel.
They are clutching each other for dear life. Slothrop glares up at this spectacle, augmented now by a cast of dozens.
Well, you see, somebody swiped all my clothes, and I was just on my way to complain to the management, but decided to put on a purple bedsheet and climb a tree instead,
nods the general.
Well, I dare say we can fix you up with something. Bloat, you're nearly this man's size, aren't you?
Oh.
Croquet mallet over his shoulder, posed like an advertising display for Kilgore or Curtis, smirking down at Slothrop.
I have a spare uniform somewhere. Come along, Slothrop. You're all right, aren't you? Didn't break anything?
Yarr!
Wrapped in his tattered sheet, helped to his feet by solicitous croqueurs, Slothrop goes limping after Bloat, off the turf and into the casino. They stop first at Slothrop's room. He finds it newly cleaned, perfectly empty, ready for new guests. Hey! Yanking out drawers, empty as drums, every stitch of clothing he owns is gone, including his Hawaiian shirt. What the fuck? Groaning, he rummages in the desk, empty. Closets, empty. Leave papers, ID, everything taken. His back muscles throb with pain. What is this, Ace? Going to check out the number on the door again, everything now for form's sake, he knows. Hogan's shirt bothers him most of all. First put on something respectable. Bloat's tone full of headmasterish revulsion. Two subalterns come crashing in, carrying their valises. They halt, goggling at Slothrop. Here, mate, you're in the wrong theater of operations, cries one. Show a bit of respect, the other haw-haws. It's Lawrence of Arabia. Shit, says Slothrop. Can't even lift his arm, much less swing it. They proceed to Bloat's room, where they put together a uniform. Say, it occurs to Slothrop, where's that mucker Maffick this morning? I've no idea, really. Off with his girl or girls. Where have you been? But Slothrop's looking around, tightening rectal fear belatedly taking hold now, neck and face beading in a surge of sweat, trying to find in this room Tantivy shares with Bloat some trace of his friend. Bristly Norfolk jacket, pinstripe suit, anything. Nothing. Did that Tantivy move out or what? He may have moved in with Francoise or... what's her name? Even gone back to London early. I don't keep a file on him. I'm not the Missing Persons Bureau. You're his friend, Bloat with an insolent shrug for the very first time since they met, now looks Slothrop in the eyes. Aren't you? What are you? The answer's in Bloat's stare. The dim room become rationalized. Nothing to it of holiday, only Savile Row uniforms. Silver hairbrushes and razor arranged at right angles. A shiny spike on an octagonal base impaling half an inch of pastel flimsies, all edges neatly squared, a piece of Whitehall on the Riviera. Slothrop drops his eyes away. See if I can find him, he mumbles, retreating out the door, uniform ballooning at the ass and too tight at the waist. Live with the way it feels, mate. You'll be in it for a while. He begins at the bar they talked in last night. It is empty except for a colonel with a great twisted mustache with his hat on, sitting stiffly in front of something large, fizzing, opaque, and garnished with a white chrysanthemum.
Didn't they teach you at Sandhurst to salute? This officer screams.
Slothrop, hesitating only a moment, salutes.
Damned OCTU must be full of Nazis.
No bartender in sight. Can't remember what...
Well...
Actually, what I am is an American. I only borrowed the uniform and, well, I was looking for a lieutenant, or actually Lieutenant Mucker Maffick.
You're a what?
Roars the colonel, pulling leaves from the chrysanthemum with his teeth.
What kind of Nazi foolishness is that, eh?
Well, thank you. Slothrop backing out of the room, saluting again.
This is incredible!
The echo following him down the corridors to the Himmler Spielsaal.
It's Nazi!
Deserted in noon's lull, here are resonant reaches of mahogany, green bays, hanging loops of maroon velvet. Long-handled wood money rakes lie fanned out on the tables. Little silver bells with ebony handles are turned mouth down on the russet veneer. Around the tables, empire chairs are lined up precise and playerless. But some are taller than the rest. These are no longer quite outward and visible signs of a game of chance. There is another enterprise here, more real than that, less merciful, and systematically hidden from the likes of Slothrop. Who sits in the taller chairs? Do they have names? What lies on their smooth baize surfaces? Brass-colored light seeps in from overhead. Murals line the great room. Pneumatic gods and goddesses, pastel swains and shepherdesses, misty foliage, fluttering scarves, everywhere curlicued gilt festoonery drips from moldings, chandeliers, pillars, window frame. Scarred parquetry gleams under the skylight. From the ceiling to within a few feet of the tabletops hang long chains with hooks at the ends. What hangs from these hooks? For a minute here, Slothrop, in his English uniform,
is alone with the paraphernalia of an order whose presence among the ordinary debris of waking he has only lately begun to suspect. There may for a moment have been some golden, vaguely root-like or man-like figure beginning to form among the brown and bright cream shadows and light here, but Slothrop isn't to be let off so easy. Shortly, unpleasantly so, it will come to him that everything in this room is really being used for something different, meaning things to them it has never meant to us. Never. Two orders of being, looking identical, but... Oh, the world over there, it's so hard to explain. Just like a dream's got lost in your brain. Dancing like a fool through that forbidden wing, waiting for the light to start shivering. Well, whoever said you couldn't move that way, whoever said you couldn't try, if you find there's a little pain, you can always go back again, 'cause you don't ever really say goodbye. Why here? Why should the rainbow edges of what is almost on him be rippling most intense here in this amply coded room? Say, why should walking in here be almost the same as entering the forbidden itself? Here are the same long rooms, rooms of old paralysis and evil distillery, of condensations and residues you are afraid to smell from forgotten corruptions. Rooms full of upright gray feathered status with wings spread, indistinct faces and dust. Rooms full of dust that will cloud the shapes of inhabitants around the corners or deeper inside, that will settle on their black formal lapels, that will soften to sugar the white faces, white shirt fronts, gems and gowns, white hands that move too quickly to be seen. What game do they deal? What passes are these, so blurred, so old and perfect? Fuck you, whispers Slothrop. It's the only spell he knows, and a pretty good all-purpose one at that. His whisper is baffled by the thousands of tiny rococo surfaces. Maybe he'll sneak in tonight. No, not at night. But sometime with a bucket and brush, paint fuck you in a balloon coming out the mouth of one of those little pink shepherdesses there. He steps back out, backward out the door, as if half, his ventral half, were being struck in kingly radiance, retreating from yet facing the presence feared and wanted. Outside, he heads down toward the quay, among fun-seekers, swooping white birds, an incessant splat of seagull shit. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, saluting everybody in uniform, getting it to a reflex, don't ask for extra trouble, try for invisible, bringing his arm each time a bit more stupidly to his side. Clouds now are coming up fast out of the sea. No sign of Tent Ivy out here, either. Ghosts of fishermen, glassworkers, fur traders, renegade preachers, hilltop patriarchs, and valley politicians go avalanching back from Slothrop here, back to 1630, when Governor Winthrop came over to America on the Arbella, flagship of a great Puritan flotilla that year, on which the first American Slothrop had been a mess cook or something. There go that Arbella and its whole fleet sailing backward in formation, the wind sucking them east again, the creatures leaning from the margins of the unknown, sucking in their cheeks, growing cross-eyed with the effort, into black deep hollows at the mercy of teeth no longer the milky molars of cherubs, as the old ships zoom out of Boston Harbor, back across an Atlantic whose currents and swells go flowing and heaving in reverse, a redemption of every mess cook who ever slipped and fell when the deck made an unexpected move, the night's stew collecting itself up out of the planks and off the indignant shoes of the more elect, slithering in a fountain back into the pewter kettle as the servant himself staggers upright again and the vomit he slipped on goes bushing back into the mouth that spilled it. Presto changeo! Tyrone Slothrop's English again! But it doesn't seem to be redemption exactly that this they have in mind. He's on a broad cobbled esplanade lined with palms shifting now to coarse-grained black as clouds begin to come over the sun. Tent Ivy isn't out on the beach either, nor are any of the girls. Slothrop sits on a low wall, feet swinging, watching the front, slate, muddy purple, advancing from the sea in sheets and drifts. Around him the air is cooling. He shivers. What are they doing? He gets back to the casino just as big globular raindrops, thick as honey, begin to splat into giant asterisks on the pavement, inviting him to look down at the bottom of the text of the day, where footnotes will explain all. He isn't about to look. Nobody ever said a day has to be juggled into any kind of sense at day's end. He just runs. Rain grows in wet crescendo. His footfalls send up fine flowers of water, each hanging a second behind his flight. It is flight. He comes in speckled, pied with rain, begins a frantic search through the great inert casino, starting again with the same smoky, hooch-fumed bar, proceeding through the little theater where tonight will play an abbreviated version of L'inutile precauzione, that imaginary opera with which Rosina seeks to delude her guardian in the barber of Seville, into its green room where girls, a silkenness of girls, but not the three Slothrop wants most to see, tease hair, arrange garters, glue on eyelashes, smile at Slothrop. No one has seen Ghislaine Françoise Yvonne. From another room the orchestra rehearses a lively Rossini tarantella. The reeds are all something like a half-tone flat. At once, Slothrop understands that he is surrounded by women who have lived a good fraction of their lives at war and under occupation, and for whom people have been dropping out of sight every day. Yes, in one or two pairs of eyes he finds an old and European pity, a look he will get to know, well before he loses his innocence and becomes one of them. So he drifts through the bright and milling gaming rooms, the dining hall and its smaller private satellites, busting up tête-à-têtes, colliding with waiters, finding only strangers wherever he looks. And if you need help, well, I'll help you. Voices, music, and shuffling of cards all grow louder, more oppressive, till he stands looking into the Himmler Spielsaal again, crowded now, jewels flashing, leather gleaming, roulette spokes whirling, blurring. It's here that saturation hits him. It's all this playing games, too much of it, too many games. The nasal, obsessive voice of a croupier he can't see, Messieurs, Madame, les jeux sont faits, is suddenly speaking out of the forbidden wing directly to him and about what Slothrop has been playing against the invisible house, perhaps after all for his soul, all day. Terrified, he turns out into the rain again where the electric lights of the casino in full holocaust are glaring off the glazed cobbles. Collar up, bloats hat down over his ears, saying shit every few minutes. Shivering, his back aching from that fall out of that tree, he goes stumbling along in the rain. He thinks he might begin to cry. How did this all turn against him so fast? His friends, old and new, every last bit of paper and clothing connecting him to what he's been, have just fucking vanished. How can he meet this with any kind of grace? Only much later, worn out, snuffling, cold and wretched in his prison of soggy army wool, does he think of Katya. He gets back to the casino near midnight, her hour, tramping upstairs, leaving wet footprints behind, loud as a washing machine, stops at her door, rain pattering onto the carpet, afraid even to knock. Has she been taken too? Who's waiting behind the door, and what machinery have they brought with them? But she's heard him and opens with a dimpled, chiding smile for being so wet. Tyrone, I missed you. He shrugs, convulsive, helpless, showering both of them. It's the only place I knew to come. Her smile slowly unpurses. Gingerly he steps across the sill, then, not sure if it's door or high window, into her deep room. Good mornings of good old lust. Early shutters open to the sea. Winds coming in with the heavy brushing of palm leaves, the wheezing break to surface and sun of porpoises out in the harbor. Oh, Katya groans somewhere under a pile of their batistes and brocade. Slothrop, you pig!
Oink, 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 says Slothrop cheerfully.
Sea glare dances up on the ceiling, smoke curdles from black market cigarettes. Given the precisions of light these mornings, there are forms of grace to be found in the rising of the smoke, meander, furl, delicate fade to clarity. At certain hours, the harbor blue will be reflected up on the whitewashed sea facade, and the tall windows will be shuttered again. Wave images will flicker there in a luminous net. By then, Slothrop will be up, in British uniform, gobbling down croissants and coffee, already busy at a refresher course in technical German,
or trying to dope out the theory of arrow-stable trajectories, or tracing nearly with the end of his nose some German circuit schematic whose resistors look like coils and the coils like resistors. What bizarre shit, once he got hip to it. Why would they go and switch it around like that? Trying to camouflage it, or what? Recall your ancient German runes, suggests Sir Stephen Dotson Truck, who is from the Foreign Office PID and speaks 33 languages, including English, with a strong Oxonian blither to it. By what? Oh, lips compressing, some kind of brain nausea here. That coil symbol there happens to be very like the old Norse rune for S, Sol, which means sun. The old High German name for it is Sigil. Funny way to draw that sun, it seems to Slothrop. Indeed, the Goths much earlier had used a circle with a dot in the center. This broken line evidently dates from a time of discontinuities, tribal fragmenting perhaps, alienation, whatever is analogous in a social sense to the development of an independent ego by the very young child, you see. Well, no, Slothrop doesn't see, not exactly. He hears this sort of thing from Dotson Truck nearly every time they get together. The man just materialized one day, out on the beach in a black suit, shoulders starred with dandruff from thinning carrot hair, coming into view against the white face of the casino, which trembled over him as he approached. Slothrop was reading a Plastic Man comic. Katya was dozing in the sun face up, but when his footpads reached her hearing, she turned on one elbow to wave hello. The peer flung himself to full length. Attitude 8.11, torpor, undergraduate. So this is Lieutenant Slothrop. Four-color Plastic Man goes oozing out of a keyhole, around a corner, and up through piping that leads to a sink in the mad Nazi scientist's lab, out of whose faucet Plass's head now blank, carapaced eyes and unplastic jaws just emerging. Yeah, who are you, Ace? Sir Stephen introduces himself, freckles roused by the sun, eyeing the comic book curiously. I gather this isn't a study period. Is he cleared?
He's cleared.
Katya smiling, shrugging at Dotson Truck. Taking a break from that telefunken radio control, that Hawaii Eye. You know anything about that? Only enough to wonder where they got the name from.
The name?
There's a poetry to it, engineer's poetry. It suggests havari, average, you know. Certainly you have the two lobes, don't you, symmetrical about the rocket's intended azimuth. Howen, too, smashing someone with a hoe or a club, off on a voyage of his own here, smiling at no one in particular, bringing in the popular wartime expression abhowen, quarter-staff technique, peasant humor, phallic comedy dating back to the ancient Greeks. Slothrop's first impulse is to get back to what that Plass is into, but something about the man, despite obvious membership in the plot, keeps him listening. An innocence, maybe a try at being friendly, in the only way he has available, sharing what engages and runs him, a love for the word. Well, it might be just Axis propaganda, something to do with that Pearl Harbor.
Sir Stephen considers this, seeming pleased. Did they choose him because of all those word-smitten Puritans dangling off of Slothrop's family tree? Were they trying to seduce his brain now, his reading eye, too? There are times when Slothrop actually can find a clutch mechanism between him and their iron-cased engine far away up a power train whose shape and design he has to guess at, a clutch he can disengage, feeling then all his inertia of motion, his real helplessness. It is not exactly unpleasant, either. Odd thing. He is almost sure that whatever they want, it won't be too much of his comfort. But he can't fit any of it into a pattern. There's no way to connect with somebody like Katya. Seductress and not so bad a game. There's very... Don't blame her. She's somewhere back in that London, and this is her job. She can be versatile, gay, and kind. And he'd rather be warm here with her than freezing back under the Blitz. But now and then, too insubstantial to get a fix on, there'll be in her face a look, something not in her control that depresses him. That he's even dreamed about and so found amplified there to honest fright. The terrible chance that she might have been conned, too. As much a victim as is. An unlucky and unaccountably futureless look. One gray afternoon, in where but the Himmler Spielsaal, where else, he surprises her alone by a roulette wheel. She's standing, head-bent, gracefully hip-shot, playing croupier. An employee of the house...
peasant blouse and a rainbow-striped dirndl skirt of satin which shimmers underneath the skylight. The balls tattoo against the moving spokes, gather long, scratchy red in the muraled space. She doesn't turn till Slothrop is beside her. To her breathing, the grave, slow-beating tremor. He nudges at the shutters of his heart, open to him brief flashes of an autumn country he has only suspected, only feared, outside him, inside her.
Hey, gotcha!
Making a long arm, hooking a finger on a spoke to stop the number they never see. Seeing the number is supposed to be the point, but in the game, beyond the game, it is night. She shakes her head. He understands that it's something back in Holland, before on him, and impermanently wired into the circuit of themselves. How many ears, smelling of Palmolive and Camay, has he crooned songs into? Outside the bowling alley songs, behind the Moxie billboard songs. Saturday night, open me another quart songs, all saying, honey, it don't matter where you've been, let's not live in the past, right now's all there is. Fine, go back there. But not in here. Tapping on her bare shoulder, peering in at her European darkness, bewildered with himself with his straight hair, barely combable, and shaven face without a wrinkle, such a chaste intrusion in the Himmlerspielsaal, all crowded with German Baroque perplexities of shape. A sacrament of hands in every last turn each hand must produce, because of what the hand was, had to become, to make it all come out exactly this way, all the cold, the trauma, the departing flesh that has ever touched it. In the twisted, guilt playing room, his secret motions clarify for him some. The odds they played here belonged to the past only. Their odds were never probabilities, but frequencies already observed. It's the past that makes demands here. It whispers and reaches after, and, sneering disagreeably, gooses its victims. When they chose numbers, red, black, odd, even, what did they mean by it? What wheel did they set in motion? Back in a room early in Slothrop's life, a room forbidden to him now, is something very bad. Something was done to him. And it may be that Katya knows what. Hasn't he, in her futureless look, found some link to his own past? Something that connects them closely as lovers? He's standing at the end of a passage in her life, without any next step to take. All her bets are in. She has only tedium now of being knocked from one room to the next. A sequence of numbered rooms whose numbers do not matter till inertia brings her last. That's all. Naive Slothrop never thought anybody's life could end like that. Nothing so bleak. But by now it's grown much less strange to him. He's been snuggling up, masturbatorily scared, elated, to the disagreeable chance that exactly such control might already have been put over him. The forbidden wing. Oh, the hand of a terrible croupier is that touch on the sleeves of his dreams. All in his life of what has looked free or random is discovered to have been under some control, all the time, the same as a fixed roulette wheel, where only destinations are important. Attention is to long-term statistics, not individuals. And where the house always does, of course, keep turning a profit.
You were in London,
she will presently whisper, turning back to her wheel and spinning it again, face averted, womanly twisting the night-streaked yarn of her past.
While they were coming down, I was in Schravenhache.
Fricatives sighing, the name spoken with exiles lingering.
While they were going up, between you and me is not only a rocket trajectory, but also a life.
You will come to understand that between the two points, in the 5 minutes, it lives an entire life. You haven't even learned the data on our side of the flight profile, the visible or trackable. Beyond them, there's so much more, so much none of us know. But it is a curve each of them feels, probably. It is the parabola. They must have guessed once or twice, guessed and refused to believe, that everything, always, collectively, had been moving toward that purified shape latent in the sky, that shape of no surprise, no second chances, no return. Yet they do move forever under it. Reserved for its own black-and-white bad news, certainly as if it were the rainbow and they its children. as the war's front moves away from them, and the casino becomes more and more a rear area, as the water grows more polluted and the price rises, so the personnel coming down on leave get noisier and more dedicated to pure assholery. None of Tantivy's style about them, his habit of soft-shoe dancing when drunk, his make-believe foppishness and shy, decent impulses to conspire, however marginally, whenever possible, against power and indifference. There hasn't been a word about him. Swarthrop misses him, not just as an ally, but as a presence, a kindness. He continues to believe here on his French leave, and at his ease, that the interference is temporary and paper, a matter of messages rooted in orders cut. An annoyance that will end when the war ends. So well have they busted the sod prairies of his brain, tilled and sown there, and subsidized him not to grow anything of his own. No letters from London. Not even news of Achtung. All gone. Teddy Bloat one day just vanished. Other conspirators, like a chorus line, will show up off and on behind Katya and Sir Stephen, dancing in, all with identical corporate smiles. The multiplication of whose glittering choppers is to dazzle him, they think, distract him from what they're taking away, his ID, his service dossier, his past. Well, fuck. You know, he lets it happen. He's more interested and sometimes a little anxious about what they seem to be adding on. At some point, apparently on a whim, though how can a fellow be sure, Slothrop decides to raise a mustache. Last mustache he had was at age 30 at Johnson Smith for a whole mustache kit. 20 different shapes, from Fu Manchu to Groucho Marx. They were made of black cardboard with hooks that fit into your nose. After a while, snot would soak into these hooks, and they'd grow limp, and the mustache would fall off. What kind? Katya wants to know soon as this one is visible. Bad guy, says Slothrop. Meaning, he explains, trimmed, narrow, and villainous.
No, that'll give you a negative attitude. Why not raise a good guy mustache instead?
But good guys don't have.
Oh, no, what about Wyatt Earp?
To which might have advanced the objection that Wyatt wasn't all that good. But this is still back in the Stuart Lake era here, before the revisionists moved in. And Slothrop believes in that Wyatt, all right. One day a General Wyvern of Schaeff technical staff comes in and sees it. The ends droop down, he observes. So did that Wyatt's, explained Slothrop. So did John Wilkes Booth's, replied Earl. Eh? Slothrop ponders. He was a bad guy. Precisely. Why don't you twist the ends up? English style. Well, I tried that. It must be the weather or something. The old duster just keeps drooping down again, and I need to bite those ends off. It's really annoying. It's disgusting, says Wyvern. Next time I come round, I shall bring you some wax for it. They make it with a bitter taste to discourage end chewers, you know. So as the mustache waxes, Slothrop waxes the mustache. Every day there's something new like this. Katya's always there, slipped by them into his bed like nickels under the pillow for his deciduous Americanism. Innocent incisors and mom-worshipping molars just left in a clattering trail back down these days at the casino. For some odd reason, he finds himself with hard-ons after study sessions. That's peculiar. There is nothing specially erotic about reading manuals hastily translated from the German, brokenly mimeographed, even a few salvaged by the Polish underground, the latrines at the training Sedlizna, stained genuine SS shit and piss, or memorizing conversion factors, inches, centimeters, horsepower to Pferdestärke, drawing from memory schematics and isometric snarled maze of fuel, oxidizer, steam, peroxide, and permanganate lines, valves, vents, chambers. What's sexy about that? Still, he emerges from each lesson with great hard-on, tremendous pressure inside, some of that temporary insanity, he reckons, and goes looking for Katya, hands to crab-walk his back and silk stockings squealing against his hip bones. During the lessons, he will often look over and catch Sir Stephen Dotson's truck consulting a stopwatch and taking notes. Jeepers. He wonders what that's all about. Never occurs to him it might have to do with these mysterious erections. The man's personality was chosen, designed, to sidetrack suspicions before they have a chance to gather speed.
Winter sunlight hitting half his face like a migraine. Trouser wet and sandy because he's up every morning at 6 to walk along the Strand. Sir Stephen makes perfectly accessible his disguise, if not his function, in the conspiracy. For all Swarthrop knows, he's an agronomist, a brain surgeon, a concert oboist. In that London, you saw all levels of command seething with these multidimensional geniuses, but as with Katya, there hangs about Dotson Truck's well-informed zeal an unmistakable aura of the employee and loser. One day, Slothrop gets a chance to check this out.